All right, let's get started. Welcome to the work session of the March 4th, 2025 meeting. And our first item is a police department update from Chief Black.
For having me here tonight to do this. This actually is something I started a couple of months ago. I wanted to give an annual 2024 update. And as I talked to Ken about it a little bit, he suggested that I kind of merge this with also what would be presented for your consideration during the budget retreat also. So this is going to be a little bit of a mix of both of those things. I really would ask that if there's anything that you feel like I go too fast for, or Reader's digested this quite a bit, and sometimes I hate doing that, although I know Ted loves it when I just go on and on about stuff. To me, the police work is like transportation is to Councilmember Knowlton. It's just so exciting and stuff, but I did take some of it out. I wanted to start out and see if I can make this work. Just to give you a quick overview of where our current staffing is so that you have an understanding of where, I know you know that we have about 28 officers, but I'm sure there's times you wonder where they all are and what they're doing. And sometimes in the middle of the night, I wonder where they all are too. But our 31 FTEs, four of them are clerks and 27 of them are sworn officers. We have two patrol shifts. They both are 12-hour shifts and they run 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. and then 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And with that number, there is no overlap in any of our shifts. So we don't ever have like a double coverage time between these particular shifts. We do have, as some of you know, we have some cover officers. So instead of putting four new officers in patrol, we've identified in past years peak call times and put one patrol officer in there to kind of cover those peak areas so that we have enough officers without having to add one to each patrol and keep them equal, so to speak. But of those patrol shifts, there's four squads. So there's no overlap, but we can't have two squads working seven straight days a week. So they divide the week up between the two squads. Does that make any sense at all? So for example, an officer will work Monday and Tuesday. He'll be off Wednesday and Thursday. He'll come back and work Friday and Saturday, and then an 8-hour Sunday shift, and then the next week it's reversed. He's off Monday and Tuesday, he'll work Wednesday and Thursday, and then he'll work Friday and Saturday. So they don't work 40-hour weeks, they work 80-hour pay periods, if that's a little clearer way to put that. And so that's where the vast majority of our officers are stationed, is in the patrol division. It's the backbone of our department. It's the most visible presence of the police department and frankly of the city usually as to when we see those people out representing what our city is doing. We also have six positions in the detective division. One of them is a sergeant who oversees that. That's Sergeant Vigil. I know most of you know Cade. He's doing an excellent job there. We have one corporal, which is Chad Carlson, who's also been around for a long time. And then we have our community liaison officer. He works specific problem area policing complaints. So if we get a complaint that there is a house that the people suspect there's drug dealing going out of, or it's a nuisance type of a house, but it's not a case that's just initially investigated by patrol where a clump of information can come to them, that CLO works that information and actually has to put a case together and work that case. We have one sex crimes detective, and unfortunately, he is one of our busiest detectives, not by sheer numbers, but by the extent of work that has to go into those cases. I know that I've explained to the councils in years past, those kind of cases deserve our very best efforts. Whether the person needs to be exonerated or convicted, there's no middle ground if there's a sex abuse allegation. You can't just leave that to a chance or say, well, we really can't come to a decision one way or the other. And I'm not saying that never happens, but we owe the victim and the accused the most thorough investigation possible so that someone's name can be cleared or a victim can get justice. And that's Detective Weir. It's a very difficult job. He's interviewing, you know, dozens of children every year. He's interviewing dozens of accused individuals every year. And he's recognized in Davis County as one of the best sex crimes investigators that we have. And I'm very proud of the work that he has done and the reputation that he has brought to himself and to the city for that. We also have, we have a general investigator that works with Sergeant Viegel, who kind of investigates, takes the lead on all of the other types of cases that come through, the frauds, the assaults, the thefts, and those kinds of things, the burglaries. And then we have, as you know, in our cooperative agreement last year with Spectrum Academy, where they obtained a grant to help fund this, we have one school resource officer who's assigned to the detective division, and that's Officer Bradley. And he has just done a wonderful job this year at Spectrum. I hear almost weekly how much they appreciate him. Our calls to Spectrum have literally gone down to almost none because he's able to be there, establish a relationship with the administration and the youth, and handle those problems before they become so aggravated that patrol is having to be called in off the streets. We have, besides patrol, two officers that are assigned to deal with our traffic-related crimes. And as I go through this presentation, you'll see why that is so important for us. We also have one canine team. It's Officer Boyle and his canine, Trace. Trace is 7 years old. We're hoping that his health will hold on for another few years. It's a lot of an investment and time spent to have a canine team. But when we have alarms or intrusions on these warehouses that are thousands and thousands of square feet, it is so beneficial for us from a resource standpoint to be able to put a dog in there that can search these buildings out if there is an intruder, or search a field or look for those things. It literally saves dozens of man hours, and dogs just can smell better than we can find people hiding. So I'm happy to report that in the years that we've had canine officers, we have made a number of apprehensions, but our handlers are very professional, and we've never had a dog bite yet, which I think is wonderful, because a lot of times those dogs, when they do find a perpetrator, it's very difficult for handlers to have the discipline with that dog not to have a bite occur, and our handlers have trained those dogs to be extremely responsive and obedient. And if you've ever had the chance to watch them out at our Night Out Against Crime or any other canine demo, you'll see that level of obedience, and that's not just something that comes easy. I'm kind of the Henry Blake of training dogs. You know, dogs do whatever they want in my house, and that's why they're not there anymore. So anyway, and then we have four non-sworn clerks. One is our office manager, that's Jana. One and a half positions are records clerk full-time. So Raylene is a full-time records clerk, and Brittany is a half-time records clerk, and then she's also our half-time victim specialist. That has also been one of those positions that has just proven to be invaluable to us. We do have victim advocates in Davis County, but unfortunately, the need for victim advocates is ever increasing. And when we have victims of abuse or domestic violence in our city, they know that they can reach out to her, and she has sometimes better ideas and better ends with the county attorney's office and our own city attorneys to help them obtain protective orders, to get an immediate response for service of protective orders, and also to ensure that they have been followed up with properly from the initial call. And then we have one full-time evidence forensic clerk, and I look forward to the next city council meeting, hopefully bringing her and some of the detectives up because of the outstanding work that they have done and continue to do. This is a really brief summary of our calls last year. We had about 9,800 calls, about 27 calls for service a day. And that's very busy. When you consider that we have 2 to 3 patrol officers on at a time, they're moving from call to call. Some of those calls only take a few minutes to resolve. Some calls can take 3 officers hours to resolve. Earlier this week on 7th West, we had a fire assist. You wouldn't think that's that big of a deal, but we ended up having to close 7th West down for 3 or 4 hours, and it took all 3 of our officers off of the street for 3 or 4 hours to do that. So a call for service is really hard to just gauge and say, what does that equal? But 9,800 calls for service is substantial. Of those 9,800 calls, almost 3,300 of them were related to traffic problems. And throughout my years working in law enforcement, traffic-related issues continue to be the number one complaint of our city and our citizens. And it's fair. It's Traffic is a scary thing for parents. It's a scary thing for drivers that are just learning to drive. It's a quality of life issue to have a loss of control when you have vehicles moving through your neighborhoods at speeds that are either are or perceived to be too fast or reckless or anything else. Of those 3,200 incidents that were traffic related, 504 of them were accidents, about almost 60 of them were hit and runs. We had 108 people injured to the degree that they had to be medically treated or transported, and over $3.5 million of estimated damage, and that's a low estimate. We're just not good insurance adjusters, and so we might think a bumper just needs a little bit of touch-up paint when we find out later on it was a $2,000 replacement of an entire bumper. But that's a lot of damage that we're dealing with every year. 36 of those traffic-related calls were either DUIs, either alcohol or drug-related. That's an astounding number of DUIs driving through our street that we just catch, and it's going up every year. And then just in our other patrol calls, we had 60 cases that were primarily drug-related cases. That means that was the investigation that was called in and investigated. It doesn't mean that there was only 60 cases where drugs were involved, but 60 actually started out as drug-related cases. We had 337 cases of domestic violence last year, that resulted in 90 arrests. That was protective order violations and other types of home abuse. This is one of our priorities in the police department, and I know that the Constitution is focused on government intrusion, but I think we can all agree that from the earliest days of this nation, our homes should be the safest place for us. We should be secure in our homes, and that's not just from the worry that the military or the police or the government's going to intrude, but it should be for someone to feel safe there. And when we have this many victims that don't feel safe in their own homes, that is a concerning thing for the police department. We review every domestic violence case as a command staff every year, or every 2 weeks we review these. And so every year we review all 337 of those cases to do everything that we can, not only as the initial responders, but as a command staff to make sure that the case was investigated properly, that it's moving through the arrest and screening process properly, and that all resources that are available are offered to victims, whether it be protective orders or whether they need shelter, whether they need anything else. And that's one of the things that Brittany also helps us out with. Our detectives investigated 662 cases, resulting in 146 follow-up arrests last year. So I hope that just gives you a brief summary of how much work is being done by our police department right now. Then we have, and I'm not going to go through every one of these things, but I did want you to see a list of some of the critical technology that we are working with. These are things that we consider essential in today's world of investigating and responding to calls and doing our job as police officers. These are things that I think 10 or 15 years ago when I first started here, some of these things we were just barely hearing about, some of these things we hadn't heard anything about, and some, like the radios, as I talked about a few months ago, were just simply push a button and talk, and now they've become technical pieces of equipment that you have to really invest in, and you have to have teams that can fix them and repair them so that we can communicate properly with each other and other agencies. And some of these things are mandated by the state, and some of these things are not. Some, like our radios, although the state doesn't mandate we have police radios, they do mandate the system that public safety can speak on. And so we can't just go use, talkabouts from Walmart. We have to use a very specific type of a radio capability on public safety systems. And this year, those who have been following the legislature closely know that they're going to require that we have mobile fingerprint readers in our car to help identify individuals that don't have identification. And we're already looking into how we're going to find a vendor that can produce those for us at a decent cost. So let me move a little bit into some of the staffing needs that we are continuing to identify in the department. And I present these to you after a lot of thought. I try to just keep the city manager abreast of some of the issues that we're having. And these are not new issues to me or to Ken, I hope. These are some of these things that we've talked about for years, but as they continue to percolate and become more and more serious, these are some of the things that have risen really to the top right now. We continue to face growth issues, not just in the city of North Salt Lake, but along the Wasatch Front that affect our quality of life. And perception is reality. If someone feels like their life is unsafe in the areas that they live in, that whether that's true or borne out by statistics or whatever It doesn't matter about how they feel. I go back to the traffic example. There's a sweet lady that lives right at the entrance of Foxborough off of Center Street, first house there on the right. And for years she was saying, people are going 40 or 50 miles an hour past my house. And I would go out there with a radar gun and stand in her front yard with her, and we would point a radar, and cars were really going anywhere from 23 to maybe 30 miles an hour once in a while. There was never 50s or anything like that. But her perception is, these cars are speeding past my house terribly. And it affected her sense of safety and security for what she was, for where she lived. And those perceptions are real for people, even if it's not happening every single day. If we have even one instance, like we had a couple of months ago up in the foothills with those individuals that were breaking into cars, and we saw they were carrying guns on Ring doorbells, that only needs to happen once for people to be feeling very, very unsettled in their homes, and that this is not a safe a place to be. So we take that perception as well as the reality very seriously. And we also, we being the police administration, take very seriously the security and safety of our officers. An officer that is placed in an unsafe position often will make very poor decisions to protect their own lives. It's just the natural instinct that will kick in. And so we do everything we can to train them to not enter into calls alone that they don't have to. To call, backup's available. If you don't need to be cowboying things like this. If you get into a situation that seems a little dicey, slow it down a little bit. Call for additional officers. Call for that additional help that you need. Don't go on domestic violence cases alone. Don't go on seemingly civil problems alone. I'm not going to try to take up too much of your time, but one of the worst cases I ever got myself into as a young officer was, I was just going to stand by to keep the peace while a separated couple wanted their child to get his school books from another parent. And I'm not, still to this day, not quite sure how I let that get out of hand, but about 20 officers later, he got his school books. And I got a nice letter in my file for letting it get to that point. So we want our officer safety to be key also. We're also recognizing that we are a smaller city, but we live in a large metropolitan area. We can't deny the effect that decisions that are being made by cities and by individuals within the cities in Salt Lake, our largest city, and Layton and Bountiful and everything else affect us. We can try to mitigate some of these things with memorandums of understanding, but there's also some very good task forces that are out there. We participate on a part-time basis with the Regional Computer Forensics Lab and with the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, because they are really critical things. But there's other task forces that we have not been participatory in, and one of them I'll talk about is the Metro Narcotics Task Force. It just has really risen to a level where fentanyl and other dangerous drugs are in our community, and it's frightening, just the, not just the what could happen, but some of the results that we've seen in the last year. I think it's also important to understand that North Salt Lake may not be the biggest city in the state, but we're one of the most diverse cities to work in. We have every major thoroughfare on the Wasatch Front, I think, don't we, Ted? Just about runs through North Salt Lake somewhere. Redwood Road, Highway 89, 215, I-15. I know we don't have I-70, but short of that, we have just about every major form of road transportation that comes through our city. We have railroads. We have industrial areas. We have manufacturing areas. We have all sorts of types of housing, everywhere from high-density subsidized rentals to some of the most beautiful, extravagant homes in the state. And so our socioeconomic and our racial diversity, and I don't mean that just for race, but with that comes language. We've been investigating a case the last couple of weeks that I have been so thankful for our Spanish-speaking officers that have been able to communicate effectively with victims and with suspects and to try to get to the best resolution. So with that in mind, the police administration has been talking the last year about some of the gaps that we continue to see become critical. And a couple of these gaps have become very concerning to us, to the point that we feel like it's time to come to the city manager and to the city council and say, this is what we need to fill these gaps, to provide the level of service that we feel like we owe this community and what we've committed to. Now, we also recognize that these gaps are a policy decision by the city council. So I'm presenting these to you so that you have an informed base onto why we feel like these are such serious problems right now. We want to add one officer to our patrol division. We finally reached a point in size where if we have one officer resign, we go short for 6 or 7, sometimes over a year, because of the time it takes to recruit and train and not just train in the academy, but train locally and get them ready for field work. And I have said this before, I would rather run short than hire a substandard officer just to fill a seat in a police car. And so we are very thorough in how we go through these processes. Just this week alone, we've washed 2 candidates we have 2 vacancies right now. We've washed 2 candidates out because of psychological testing and things that have come up that to me are just so distasteful that I would never feel confident in putting that officer with the authority and the position they have in a role of a police officer in this city to deal with our citizens. So the loss of one officer is really hard on our department. Like I said, we've got 2 vacancies right now. We have 2 officers that have announced their intentions to retire, which in some ways is nice. We're finally getting to points where officers aren't just quitting, but they're retiring. But within the next 2 or 3 months, we're going to have 2 officers retire from service. And we're scrambling to find enough people. So what I'm asking for this year is the ability to hire 1 patrol officer so that when we do have a retirement or a vacancy or a long-term injury, we are not having these gaps in our staffing. If we lose an officer off of day shift, that shift goes from 3 officers to 2, and that officer can't get time off. Neither of those 2 officers can get time off. It really just creates a burnout situation. It creates a situation where they're tired of overtime and all of those other things. I mean, you would think, hey, there's overtime available, they ought to be jumping on this, and they do, but eventually even that starts to become a problem, and it's just not a good morale situation for the department. It also keeps us from keeping other assignments filled. So if we have to pull a detective out to put him in patrol, which we have done, but now we've got those 672 cases being investigated by even fewer detectives. And I won't say that it has happened, but I can't say that that would not result in a substandard investigation and maybe not as thorough as it should have been. So that is one of the asks that we're asking this year. One of the things I would like to point out is that we already run short every year. And I don't think that even though we ask for the financial support to staff that, we probably will run short enough that we won't use every bit of that because we will have vacancies. Right now, with the two officers that we're currently not staffing with, we're paying overtime with that. And we really probably could hire another officer for the rest of this year with those underruns. And so, even though we're asking for the full cost of this, it won't be something we fully expend every year. But I don't feel good about coming to the council and saying, will you give me 75%? And then we have a miraculous year where we don't lose anybody. I would rather have that money unspent and returned at the end of the year. This was just kind of some of the things I've already gone over. And like I said, you have a lot of this in your packet. You can see these things. And I've talked about these issues. The second position we're asking for is that we finally step up as a city in Davis County and add an officer to the Davis Metro Narcotics team. This team has been funded and primarily run through Layton Police Department for over 20 years, and they've done a great job with it. But they do a lot of work in the South End, and Bountiful is the only city in the South End that participates with a full-time officer. We had 30 drug overdose calls last year. 4 of those resulted in fatalities. Metro Narcotics is in our city on a weekly basis, and I know of at least 1 case up on Highway 89 where they intercepted 50,000 fentanyl pills. Now, 50,000 seems, well, they were going to distribute those all over the state. Those 50,000 pills would have been in this community had we not stopped those, because that is distributable numbers, but locally distributable numbers. Metro Narcotics does a fantastic job looking at these cases before they even come to Davis County and North Salt Lake. They have cases that they worked as far away as Phoenix, that they were able to develop informants out of, and as close to North Salt Lake as our residences, our apartments, our convenience stores, our parking lots, and our schools. Thankfully, it hasn't really hit our elementary schools, but our kids are still going to Bountiful and Woods Cross High Schools, and that's a really scary area for us to have this happen. So this is, I think we've really reached a point. Metro Narcotics has asked me for over a decade when we're going to be able to staff this. And I've really thought about the value that we get from them now. But I think we've really reached a point where, as good county citizens, we need to be participating with them with manpower and not just cheering them on with a few thousand dollars for office supplies every year. Oh, I went too far. So really, those are the two asks that we are asking for this year. I can't say that we don't have any other percolating issues, but I do think that these issues have bubbled to the top now, and I am happy to answer any questions or, you know, make any clarifications that the council may have on this.
I do have one question.
Okay.
When an officer retires, does that wage help with some of the balance of hiring new officers?
That's a great question. It does, because we never hire an officer in at a topped out salary, even if they have experience. We will give them 1 year experience for another agency for a year's credit where they fall into our chart, but we usually cap that at 7 years. The city policy that, I don't even know if it's a written policy, but the model that I have followed is, if I ever have wanted to hire someone above that seventh step, I've gone to Ken and Heidi to make sure there's money there. But I cannot remember a time other than maybe Deputy Chief Fritz that we've ever really done that. So that's a great question, Councilmember Clayton. I appreciate it.
And then the other thing is, I do appreciate that you take into consideration psychological background and things, because we see far too many stories of others that have problems, and much appreciated for that. So thank you.
Thank you.
I have a, thank you for this and a compliment, because I really do feel strongly that as great as some of the fun things and the arts and activities and great things that we offer, the nuts and bolts and expectations from our citizens are infrastructure, fire, and safety, police. And,
thank you, I agree.
And I think that when we strip it all down, this is the most important ask, because this is what people expect but also need. And so thank you. I am in full support of both of these things. I was wondering, because you mentioned it, I think it's HB 392. It's so hard to remember all these numbers, but it was killed in Senate committee, and I did get word that it came back this morning and was passed by Senator Adams, so I'm guessing there's some weight behind it.
Is this the unlicensed driver bill?
Yes. So yeah. I was wondering, how many unlicensed drivers do we tend to pull over here? And does, I believe it allows you to impound the car so you don't ticket them and then off they go with their unlicensed status. And yeah, then the fingerprinting, I think both of those are in there.
That's where the mandated fingerprint reader is going to be, is it did get resurrected. There was one change that was made, and I cannot remember what that change was, but Representative McPherson from West Valley is the one that presented that. Mm-hmm. I don't have our data specifically, but his data that he presented from West Valley City was 50% of their accidents involve unlicensed drivers. Yeah. So I asked Officer Marquez, who's our primary traffic accident investigator, what his guesstimate was. And he said it's not 50%, but he said it's not uncommon. Weekly, we find accidents with people driving on either no license or revoked or suspended or an alcohol suspension. One of the things I want to be very clear about, though, is that bill, I think, has been lumped in with a lot of immigration type of bills, and I understand why, but it is not just immigrants that are in that situation. It is people that just don't feel like the rules apply to them. They don't want to get driver's licenses. They don't want to comply with that. They want to let their licenses become expired or revoked or suspended for DUIs or other convictions, and they don't have valid licenses. So I guess in some ways I'm grateful that bill came back, because we were not able to impound cars before. The one thing that I wish it would have been is a more of a may impound a car. It's a you shall impound a car.
Oh, really?
And that in some cases does put us in a little bit of a bind. The nice thing is Representative McPherson did leave a public safety out on that. So if we happen to pull over a driver that has young kids and it's snowing and it's a busy traffic, situation, and the only offense is an unlicensed driver and maybe speeding, that there is not a mandatory impound. We can wait for a licensed driver or someone to come and drive that car home. But it will be interesting how this bill plays out with law enforcement in general.
And then will that impact our budget? Because
the fingerprint readers are about $500 each.
Is that a shall or a may?
It's a shall. Yeah. It's a officers will be required to obtain a digital fingerprint if the person does not have valid identification. So for an example, last night I thought I was a police officer for a couple of minutes and stopped a car for a minor equipment violation, and it turned out that the driver had no driver's license. They put the wrong plates on the car and wasn't carrying insurance. They did have a out-of-country identification card, which I can show you a picture of it. I'm not quite sure if it was real or not. It had numbers on it, like it looked like it was real. He didn't remember his date of birth that was on his ID from that country, as opposed to what he told us, but he was pretty close. And because he had no insurance, I felt strongly that we needed to impound that car that night. And I think that, and I want to say, very polite. His dad came, very understanding and working with us, knew that they'd made a mistake. But he had no business having this unregistered, uninsured car driving down the street by an unlicensed driver. That's an accident waiting to happen. Mm-hmm. And who pays the price for that but the innocent person who's hit? So.
Yeah. Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you, Chief. I really appreciate this presentation and the work that you're doing. I agree with you about the idea of perception equals your lived reality, and that sense of safety matters so much for our citizens. And speaking for myself, I feel very safe in the city,
Thank you.
I'm grateful for that. I know you're presenting to us, and I'm very grateful as we move into budget season so that we can make a decision in budgeting in a couple of weeks. So I have a couple of questions that I would love to have the answers to before we do the budget decision. But if I don't,
if I can't
expect,
answer them tonight,
yeah,
I will get the answer.
I don't
to
necessarily
you.
Expect you to know right now. First of all, I noted that you have only a half-time employee for a victim advocate. Is that potentially a place where you would like to expand? I think that that's an incredibly valuable resource to the community.
Thank you.
But if you feel like that person is able to meet the need that is there right now, that might not be an area where we would want to grow.
I think right now she's able to meet the victim advocate needs that we're facing, because she is able to, at the rate of about 3 or 4 victims a week that need contact. And keep in mind, not all of the victims that we contact want support. It's about 50% that initially will respond to that support, and then another half will drop off with support in the longer term. One area that Ken and I have talked about for years, and I continue to drop the ball, that we would like to see maybe support, and not from, say, the city, but maybe community through a 501c3 or something like that, is to have a fund available for emergency services. For example, the shelter for Davis County will not take males over the age of 14. So if we have a mother who is in an unsafe situation with a 14 or 15-year-old son, the shelter won't take them with their son. And we really get in a bind as to where do they go for that emergency week or so. And I keep thinking in the back of my mind, we could have a few, and this is not tens of thousands of dollars, but a fund that's administered through a 501c3 that's overseen by an independent board, but we have access to maybe put somebody up in an extended stay for a week or something like that. We've had situations where we've had individuals who are homeless in our city that our officers have bought food for them, or we've gone down to the DI and gotten coats or shoes for young people. Just I know this sounds horrible, but a slush fund kind of to help people that are in emergency need. And frankly, I'm sometimes just unsophisticated on how to put these things together. Ken has helped me in the past with this, and I just need to really buckle down myself and figure something out. And I'm open to anybody who has ideas on how to put something like that together. But that's not an ask that I would come to the taxpayers for. I think that we have enough. I think this community is blessed enough and has enough good-hearted people that we could fund that through donations.
Thank you. I like that idea. And I would support the city contributing to that as well, just like we've contributed to other nonprofits and services that they provide. Another question. I appreciate the data on the number of phone calls in the year. It would also help me understand the picture a little bit more if I knew the number of incidents for which those phone calls were being made. Like if we get 9,800 phone calls, but eight people called about one car accident, sure, it really reflects a different number of events.
So let me be clear on that. The 9,800 calls were calls for service. They weren't necessarily phone calls. Those were calls in which an officer was either dispatched or self-dispatched.
So those are the incident numbers.
Yeah. So if we have a fire and nine people call in on that fire, that's one call for service for the fire department and one call for service for the police department. A traffic accident would be one call for service even if five or six people called in. But it could also be a self-generated call for service. So say an officer observes a fight in a parking lot and calls out and says, I'm on a fight, I need four officers. That's one call for service.
Thank you. That answers that question. It would also be helpful for me to see data on the use of overtime in the department. If we see that we're really spending quite a big budget on overtime, that can easily answer the question of whether we want to hire a new employee to avoid the need for overtime. That would be helpful for me.
I probably need to have Heidi help me track that just a little bit. We do use our overtime budget, but one thing to keep in mind is overtime is not the end all, because overtime is really beyond that 40 hours, and we can't just rely on somebody to always work 50, 60 hours a week. So
absolutely,
from a it's not just a financial ask on that situation, but I understand what you're saying.
That would just make it super easy to say for sure this is the right choice.
Yeah, we pretty much use our overtime budget every year, but I'll try to get the specific numbers with Heidi on that.
Chief, can I just dovetail on that? Because I had a question about, so let's say it's I've got a half hour left on my shift, and I just get involved in something, that's going to be an overtime situation.
It sure is, yeah. And we do it in 15-minute increments per FLSA guidelines.
So that might not answer the question of, that might not get quite at that answer of being over or understaffed. Okay, then my last questions are on the narcotics team specifically. Where is this physically located, and would the staff member or the police officer from North Salt Lake be on site here in North Salt Lake, or would they be on site somewhere else, full time on site out of the city?
Yeah.
And then if I'm understanding, they largely are doing detective work.
Yes.
And then what is the size of this team?
Right now, I think there are about nine detectives. That includes the lieutenant, and there's a lieutenant and two sergeants. Layton provides the lieutenant, one of the sergeants, and then I believe they supply four of the task force officers, and then Syracuse, Clearfield, Bountiful, and Davis County Sheriff provides the other sergeant, and then the others come from Syracuse, Clearfield, and Bountiful.
They're
actually physically housed. They move from time to time because they are a very undercover covert team. They're physically housed right now in Layton, but they have moved from Clearfield and other cities where they operate off of something that doesn't look like a police department.
And I don't understand the hierarchy very well, so
sure,
just help me understand why this would be a regional issue and it's not state or like an FBI or Bureau of BATF issue that they are investigating these types of regional crimes, narcotics crimes, instead of locally.
So the Drug Enforcement Agency, the national DEA, has a office in Denver, and they have a sub-office in Salt Lake. And their agents participate with the Salt Lake Metro DEA Task Force. There's just too much work, frankly. So there's another group that works under the umbrella of the DEA, and it's called the HIDA. It stands for High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area. And there's all of these HIDAs throughout the country, and we're in the Rocky Mountain HIDA area. And Rocky Mountain HIDA is not a task force per se, but it's a funding mechanism to these smaller task forces that the DEA doesn't actually put agents on. The Davis Metro Narcotics Task Force is a HIDA agency. So we get funding from Rocky Mountain HIDA out of Denver to help pay for like the overtime, a lot of the equipment, and things like that. There's also office funds that small cities have paid for in the past, which is what we've been asked to do. I think the mayor sits on the, what's it called, the county board of leaders, or COG, Council of County Governments. And years ago, there was an agreement that if you didn't have someone on, you still had to pay a certain amount per resident to help fund just the administrative supplies size of that. But frankly, the drug problem is just too vast for one task force to handle it. People are surprised, but I think we only have about 30 DEA agents assigned to the state of Utah. And I'm not exactly sure on that number, but that's roughly where it was last I'd heard.
And why would the county not be funding this? Like, why is this not something that the county police staff, this is their job entirely?
Sure. Well, they participate with it through their law enforcement side by putting a deputy sergeant on the task force. But I don't know. I mean,
and I don't know the reasons or like
I don't
what
either.
That hierarchy is.
I'm sure the county
I'm just trying
commission,
to think about it.
I'm sure the county commission probably feels the same as saying, hey, this is something that affects North Salt Lake. It affects
well, it affects the whole county. That's the whole point, is this is meant to be a regional effort. And when we're talking about now a regional effort, I think we're talking about county level. But I'm not trying to get in the
I
way
totally agree
of this
with what
moving
you're
forward.
Saying. And there's a lot of things that make sense. And it affects the state and the nation also. But these task forces are formed up in particular areas that would not be well served by resorting back to just the DEA or even a statewide task force. There is a state Division of Narcotics, a Division of Narcotics Squad, but again, that falls under the Department of Public Safety, and there's just no way that even Davis County would get that the attention they needed.
And then, if we approve this position, it is there now indefinitely, so that when this person no longer wants this, we are perpetually.
Yes, we'll always keep
this.
An officer assigned to that task force.
And then, who has supervision oversight for whether this staff member that North Salt Lake is paying for is of the quality of what we want?
Yes, and that's a really great question, and I'm glad you brought that up. So there is currently a working memorandum of understanding where the chiefs and the sheriff manage this as a board of operators, and we approve who is selected to be the lieutenant and the two sergeants. Again, Layton has been good enough to step up with that resource because a lieutenant and a sergeant is a much more expensive resource than an officer. But the current lieutenant there is, I wish he could be hired here. He is a high quality leader. In fact, I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, but it sounds to me like he's going to be resigning from Layton and going to take the assistant police chief job in Syracuse, because Syracuse has recruited him from Layton to come and serve in that position. So it'll be interesting who now steps up with a overall supervisor to do that. My guess is it will again be Layton. I know kind of who they're considering. He's a great leader. We are still a small enough county that we know who some of the great leaders are in the county, and I'm confident that we will find good leaders. I will say this, if we could not find a good leader from another agency, I would be coming back to the council saying we have a good leader, and I know that we do, that we would, instead of having just a task force officer, we would want to step up and have a leadership role in that.
So for Chief, general oversight, sorry.
Oh, you bet.
For general oversight, the narcotics team supervisor will be telling us if the officer we are paying for is doing a good
yes.
job. But you won't be doing that type of oversight.
We'll still be doing his annual evaluation, but we will be doing it based on information that is sent back from that task force. I guess the clearest way to maybe explain it is think of it as a detective squad that works off-site, and the leader of that detective squad will let us know if there's problems.
Great, thank you. And I really ask because I think that you're excellent at maintaining a quality staff.
Thank you.
I understand the need is greater than capacity. My question is relating to the fourth bullet point on this. If you can just unpack that a little bit. It says we need to be part of the upfront dissuasion and interdiction, which sounds great. I'm having trouble understanding how does that actually occur? How does having an additional officer, where and how do we dissuade interdict?
The dissuasion and the interdiction is trying to identify these drug trafficking organizations and the transportation of these drugs that are coming to our community before they actually get here. And believe it or not, things that you see in dramatizations are really dramatizations of things that aren't that far off. There are cartels that are involved in shipping drugs on a daily basis from Mexico, through Arizona, through Colorado, through California, through Nevada, that come into Salt Lake. And we all know that Salt Lake is a regional transportation area, they all come here and they're distributed out. Some of them never stay in the state. Some of those drugs never stay in the state of Utah if they're not interdicted, but a lot do. And that's really where this task force of if we participated, it'll probably go to 9 or 10 officers. it takes three or four of these detectives to work a case. We don't just send, just like with our regular detectives on any kind of a case, we don't just send one officer out to do this alone. Narcotics work is extremely dangerous. These people are serious about what they would do to communities and to informants and things like that. But it truly is working up the ladder. Instead of just arresting the kid at the high school that's handing out pills, these are the detectives, and this is the squad that would say, okay, where did it come from? And then let's go up the ladder. Let's see if we can find this. And they've really been this Davis Metro team, I am impressed at the constant awards that they are getting from the Rocky Mountain HIDA. They were the task force of the year of all the Intermountain task forces last year for the work that they did. And it's, I wish I could really share with you some of the things that they send out that's law enforcement sensitive. I get a monthly report of the work that this task force is doing in and out of Davis County. And I'm amazed at the thousands of dollars, the number of weapons, and the amounts of drugs that they're seizing before they ever get into our community.
A question or two. You say North Salt Lake is more vulnerable than the other cities in Davis County. Explain that.
Yeah, I'm saying that we're as or more vulnerable just because of where we are. We're right next to Salt Lake City, which is the main transportation hub for most of these drugs that come into the state of Utah. I mean, it's pretty clear, and I don't think this will surprise anybody, but Midvale, West Valley, Salt Lake, that central area is infested with drug-related problems. We can drive down State Street, we can drive down 35th South and see these problems, and we are the closest city in Davis County to those problems. I'm probably not giving away a state secret. Our Flying J truck stop, there's a number of operations that are conducted down at that Flying J truck stop because of it being somewhat remote, but it's also close enough that it makes a very convenient place for some of these major transportation mules, I guess, is kind of the term we call them, to do their business. But it's not just there. We've had them occur in grocery store parking lots. And these are just places that we know about. But I really do feel that North Salt Lake is in a particularly geographically vulnerable place to be susceptible to the drug trafficking that's going on in Davis County. I can tell you this, if it comes to Salt Lake and it ends up in Layton, it came through North Salt Lake. And that's like water flows downhill type of mentality, right, Karen? But, that's why I would say we're vulnerable.
Okay. So the geographic situation.
Yeah.
Okay, the second question, I guess, is that you've got other participating agencies, Bountiful, Kaysville, Davis County, Clearfield, and Syracuse. In the past, how was it that North Salt Lake participated? Was it only by a memorandum of understanding or a dues?
It's an assessment, and I don't know what the annual assessment is right now. I think we're up to about $30,000 or $40,000 a year that we're paying up to Layton City. And the cities that don't participate with manpower pay that in,
okay,
and that covers some of their operational costs. And granted, that is substantially cheaper than an officer.
Yeah.
But it also is, the city isn't getting the same level of service, and we're not really serving the rest of the greater community by just helping pay for pens and pencils and gasoline and things like that.
All right. And then the $40,000 has got to be going for more than office supplies.
No, it's going for total overall operational, but there's probably a few $100,000 a year that goes for fuel and travel.
But what I don't understand then is that Bountiful, Kaysville, and the others have their own sworn officer in their agency,
in
their local law enforcement agency, who is assigned from the city to go to this task force.
Right. But they don't pay for any fuel, they don't pay for their cars, they don't pay for their travel. Those cities pay for the cost of the officer.
I see. Okay, thank you. Now, the other question I've got with regard to school resource officers.
Okay.
You mentioned that Spectrum, sounds as though you have an officer there on a daily basis?
Yes.
Do we have officers in other schools?
Not on a daily basis. We have the other public elementary schools have a DARE officer assigned to them to check in and to kind of be their point of contact and to teach DARE. But that officer that's a collateral assignment. And it would not be a good use of resources to station a full-time police officer in an elementary school.
Sure. What about West? What about Woods Cross?
Woods Cross High School?
Yeah.
Woods Cross Police Department has a full-time school resource officer at Woods Cross High School.
All right. And do we pay?
We don't pay for it, but you do through the district. The school district, just like Spectrum reimburses us a percentage, the Davis School District reimburses Woods Cross for a portion of an officer.
Okay. Maybe we'll get to this later, but with regard to the legislative session, maybe just put this in your noggin while we are talking. Please let us know what you consider to be important bills that are passing in this last week with regard to public safety and law enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a follow-up. What would be helpful, leading off of what Lisa said, for me at our budget meeting is what has been our previous contribution from North Salt Lake. And so we can just see the size difference of that. And that is it. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, actually, there was one more. That's so you referenced that by us having an officer there on the narcotics team, our city would potentially be better served. Would that officer have a specific assignment to pay attention to North Salt Lake?
Yeah, and that's a kind of one of those things that it's hard to be tangible, because the task force is well-led, and they're not going to neglect the city of North Salt Lake if we have a particular issue that has to be worked outside the scope of what our department can do with our in-department resources, if that can make sense. However, you really can't underestimate or overestimate the value of having someone whose first loyalty is back to the city that employs them. And I speak of that with experience. I was assigned to the Salt Lake Metro Gang Task Force for 2 years when I was in West Valley City. And my first loyalty was always, what is going on in West Valley? How do I get back to what, you know, I know what's happening out in these neighborhoods that I'm going to have to go back to and work someday, and this is my employing agency. So would I spend a lot of time in, say, Glendale or Rose Park or up in those areas of Salt Lake where it seemed that the gang violence in the 90s was really apparent? Yes, but I also was advocating with my partner, we got to get out to Lake Park. We've got to get out to Roxborough Park and those kinds of areas because we've got problems out there too. I'm not exactly sure how to measure that with data, but I know that these other cities chiefs have told me they are very pleased with the type of attention some of their bigger cases get. You bet.
And I have one quick clarification on all of that, just so I'm sure. So am I correct in thinking that if we pay for the salary of an officer, then we no longer have to pay the dues, so the salary is offset in our budget already by those dues that we've been paying?
Yeah, okay. That is correct.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much for your time, Council. I appreciate you listening to me tonight.
Next item is an appointment to the Civic Events Committee, and I'll turn it over to Lisa.
It's a pleasure for me to announce the appointment that I'd like to make to the Civic Events Committee of Alexis Contreras. And she's coming up right now. And I had an opportunity to get to know her only over the phone, but she is somewhat new to our area. Her husband is a Marine. And so thank him for all that he does. And she lives right here in Central City. And that was important to me, that she's within a stone's throw of City Hall. She lives in the Bamberger area. And I asked her if she would tell us a little bit about herself and what she thinks that she would like to see happen as she works with the Civic Events Committee.
Well, hi, my name is Alexis. I'm a preschool teacher. My husband is a Marine, like she said. We moved here in May of 2024, so just under a year. But I'm originally from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and it was definitely a place where you just kind of kept your head down, didn't really talk to your neighbors, anything crazy like that. And when I moved in, within 2 days, my neighbors were knocking on my door and just being welcoming, which was something I'd never experienced before. And then I drove past the sign every day that had the little link to sign up and be a volunteer. And I was like, it's not going to hurt me to sign up and just help.
Well, we're delighted that you've said yes. And so the people that would be in charge will get a hold of you as you coalesce as a group and move forward there. As I mentioned to you, there are a lot of civic events, and North Salt Lake does a good job at them. And I would suspect that there'll be some that you would be like the point person on, but not others. So it's not just labor intensive with every single event, just to let you know that. And I'll make the motion if I can. Can I do that in the work session, or do we wait for the regular session?
Okay, you're good to go.
Okay, then I'd like to make the motion that we, as a city council, approve the appointment of Alexis Contreras to the Civic Events Committee with a term ending of January 1, 2029.
I'll second it.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your willingness to serve. Let's take a break, and we'll
3 minutes.
Let's go 8. How's that for?